Welcome to the tutorial on learning for planning. I think it had variations on that theme, different types of names. That showed up. I'm not sure whether to continue or not. Yeah, so I have lots of people, like Terry is here, you are here, so I think somebody can take for me. So I guess the good thing is that we have several people who can take over for me in case I fall asleep. There is Terry there. There is Pat there. He wrote a great overview article on what? Well, I can do my best. You know, but by the way, can you people hear me? I can't hear myself. It's just too much of. It's a different story. Okay. So this is going to be a tutorial that I will do jointly with Sangbuk Yoon, who as we speak is learning his way here, and then I'm sure he'll be here pretty soon. And then there are the slides, just to make things interesting, because this is afternoon and if I give you all the slides, you just, you know, write something and fall asleep. We have made lots of changes to the slides. So in fact, you want to pay attention to what I have here rather than you know, what you may have printed earlier. I mean, there are several, it's like 90% is the same, but there's enough changes everywhere. Okay. The other thing I want to say is it's afternoon. I drank coffee and I'm going to be able to stay awake. There is Sangbuk actually who showed up. But you also should keep awake and please stop. If you're falling asleep because you can't understand something that we are saying, please stop me and ask me questions. Okay. Since we committed ourselves to be here, might as well have fun. Okay, so the history of learning and planning is a good place to start with. You know, before many of you were born, I think the hall here looks very young, there used to be a lot of work on learning in planning, okay, because we used to have planners which, you know, this is like a curve, an experimental curve about empirical performance of various planners on some reasonably silly domain, not particularly sillier than the ones we consider now, but at least this is a rocket problem with two rockets, I think it's a number of rockets. And the speed up used to be like this, you know, this guy is really bad, this guy is little worse, and this obviously is the winner who probably drew this graph because they are not timing out as fast as the other planner. Okay, so the speed up, the speed with which the planners used to work was very, very abysmal. Okay, and so you needed all the help you can get just to solve reasonable size problems. And that was in some sense a heyday for planning in learning, planning and learning research, because learning almost worked as like a crutch to help the planners solve problems. We had great models for various types of planning domains, including classical, stochastic, etc., but we couldn't solve four blocks or four rocket problems. So why are we adding stochasticity, temporal duration, everything on it, on top of it? So that's where we were using speed up learning techniques in particular. Okay. And then clearly in the last 10 or so years, we have had significant improvements in the ability we can speed the planners. Okay, so the synthesis efficiency, one of the things that we do care about, has significantly improved, and it did not happen just because, it happened mostly because we figured out great ways of providing domain independent search control to the planners. Okay, so what that meant is that the crutch is no longer needed just to solve large size problems. So these are problems which are much larger, much longer in terms of the length of the solution and so on, and you are able to solve it much faster. Okay, and this is your life. I mean, you already know that planners can solve these kinds of problems now. Okay, so much so that the interest in planning as a crutch for speeding up, interest in learning as a crutch for speeding up planning has sort of fallen on the wayside, because after all, face it, I mean, it's not like there are more customers which if that would actually start paying you money if you can solve a little larger Black Swan problem. You know, we are able to solve them in terms of the length of the solutions, etc., we are able to scale quite well. Okay, so it looked as if, I mean, and I guess it's sort of a historical view in the sense, it sort of explained why there's not been that much work in learning and planning. Okay. So this looks as if it's a short end to a long tutorial. We can leave right now. However, there are at least two very compelling reasons why, in fact, learning and planning is learning in planning or learning for planning is becoming quite important from now on. Okay, and so I want to explain to you those two reasons, and then of course review what we know about what how to do. Okay, so there are two reasons. One, of course, is while you are able to speed, you are able to reach high speed ups. It's still the case that remember there was a knowledge-based planning track for a while in the international planning competition, and they would always have that track separate from the automated planning track. Okay, that wasn't because that was mostly because knowledge-based planners were actually able to solve much larger problems with, you know, basically much better performance than even the current best domain-independent planners. Okay, what that meant is there is actually a room for improvement even in terms of speed up. You know, while compared to this, this looks better. If I showed you the knowledge-based planning results, this starts looking not as good. Okay. So there is actually a reason from the point of view of what we know, which is KB planning track, that there's a room for improvement in terms of speed up. Okay. Then there is a different issue, which is that planning is not just, excuse me, there was a question? Okay. Planning is not just about, I mean, much of what we have done, and which is sort of the usual traditional view we all have when we come to this conference or when we think about planning, is that it's a purely inference problem. Somebody gave us a model, right, and then you just have to find the plan. Whoever does it faster gets the prize, okay? But if you actually have the current super fast planner that, you know, you have downloaded from somebody's website already, and you're trying to solve somebody's domain, you know, help somebody, your friend's domain, the first thing that you have to deal with is domain modeling, okay? And you know, increasingly domain modeling is a bigger burden as you have, you know, more and more domains that you actually want to apply this technology to. And for that, again, you want tools to improve domain modeling effort, right? Make it easier. And that's another place where machine learning, learning can play a very important role. And in fact, it turns out that these two are not very different. You know, if you can start with an incomplete domain model, and during planning, I mean, so you start with an incomplete domain model, plan with it, try to execute that in the real world, and then use the feedback to improve your model. So it's like more of a complete cycle. Okay, but if you want just two completely different orthogonal motivations, you have those two. Okay, so you have there is speed up oriented motivation, and there's a domain model oriented motivation, domain model learning oriented motivation. Okay, let me go through this a little more deeply about these two different motivations. Think of the following issue. I mean, we in the planning community consider writing a general purpose planner and then throw it on anybody's domain. That's what we're going to do. Okay. Now, clearly, if in fact blocks world is the most important thing somebody cares about, or logistics is the most important domain somebody cares about, why should they take their domain and write throw it onto the all-purpose planner? They might as well write a piece of C code, or worse yet, a bunch of assembly code, which solves that particular problem fastest. Okay, there are highly domain-specific blocks world planners that Slaney and Chebo have written, for example, some years back, which beat, I think at least at that time, they used to beat any learner, any normal automated planner by orders of magnitude. Okay. So there is an implicit assumption we have that we are not interested in individual domains, we are interested in classes of domains, and we want to have this general model that we want to understand. But implicit in that assumption is also a commitment that we don't want to live as a unhappy, inefficient general purpose planner all our life. We want to be able to customize ourselves to the distribution of the problems that come across, to the properties of the domain that we wind up learning over a period of time. Okay, so we really do want to get here, but without writing C code. That's the promise of AI. That's the promise of general purpose planning. And there are two ways of doing it. One, of course, is you know, essentially provide to the general purpose planner domain specific knowledge, which further customizes that planner. So here I will differentiate between domain physics, which is just the bunch of actions with their preconditions and effects, and the control knowledge, which is what are the right solutions, how do you go about getting those. Okay. And so the normal PDDL specification of various domains, you can think of it as a domain physics. Okay. And what we are interested in is there is more than that. There is probably you want to know, you want a rich uncle which tells you go this direction if you want a solution. Clearly domain independent heuristics do that to some extent, the reachability heuristics. But you might actually do much better just, you know, by taking the properties of the domain into account. And knowledge based planning track, to the extent it's been way better in performance than the general purpose planning track. It must be because, in fact, there are domain regularities that you could have easily, at least humans, such as Dana and Fahim, who are normal humans, the last I checked, they are able to get that and put that into normal plan. Okay. Now, the other option, now that this works, the other option is you learn, so to customize your plan, to improve its performance over a period of time, So this is essentially the idea of speed up learning, and this is important for variety of reasons. Sometimes the domain might actually be, these domains might be hard and you need to learn the search control, okay. Sometimes these domains are actually cheap, in the sense that they are probably polynomially solvable. And you know that in a PDDL style specification, so if you give like a simple strip style specification, the substrate underneath you is a piecewise complete substrate. Okay, so you're taking a polynomial time problem and you're throwing it onto a piecewise complete substrate. And the only way you can get back to polynomial time is if you were to be able to exploit the domain knowledge. Okay, and so you would like to learn that. So that's a pretty powerful motivation. And so this is sort of summarizing that. Don't we have pretty fast planners? Yes, we do have pretty fast planners, but if the domains are hard, humans are still able to get knowledge that they can put into their planners that can, beat the heck out of the domain independent, current fastest domain independent planners. Okay. And if the domains are easy, then we still need to actually exploit the ease of the domain. If it is in fact a polynomial style domain, rather than write a special purpose procedure, you should be able to asymptotically exploit that. So there is a reason there. Okay. Furthermore, even though you might say, well, we are able to solve large sized problems, but it's really the question of the strength of the solution and so on is very much a property of the underlying dynamics. For deterministic classical planning scenarios, we can solve very large problems. By the time you throw in durative actions, you cut down the scale up, you throw in stochastic action, you throw in partial observability, every one of these extra features on the domain expressiveness, your ability to scale basically is going down exponentially, right? And so to the extent we don't want to just hang around in the deterministic domains all our lives, we do need speed up potential. So that's one reason why we'll be looking at it. And to that extent, for those of you who are into competitions, actually there's going to be a learning for planning track in the international planning competition starting next year. And so the structure, there are many ways they can do it, but this one actually is interested in the control knowledge that the speed up that I just talked about till now. And what they're interested in is to have a structure like this where you want to have the same thing as the IPC test domains. Except you will have for the learning track, you have an extra time called learning phase during which they're given the domains and they can essentially train themselves on that domain, generate the problems and train themselves. And then during the test phase, everybody, both the learning and the non-learning planners are subjected to the same domains, and the learning planners are compared to each other, non-learning planners are compared to each other. So there is going to be an actual track starting next year. And so in fact, that's one reason. Now, part of the reason it's happening is because speed up is indeed an important issue. Okay. Contact Alan Fern at Oregon State University if you're interested in more details on that. And also, of course, you can win this competition if you listen to us to the very end, because there are secrets of winning this competition, we'll tell you. Okay. The second one, remember that I told you there are two different orthogonal motivations. The other motivation is domain modeling burden. Okay. The question is there really a domain modeling burden in planning? After all, currently domain modeling burden is the burden of the people who make the benchmarks, the Jörg Hoffmanns and the Alfonso Jerovinis of the world, who have by mistake agreed to run the competition and now they have to write the domains. Okay, and they actually know how painful it is to write domains. Okay, if you tried to use a current planner to run somebody else's domain, you would have known too that how painful it is to write a domain. Okay, increasingly there is a realization that there are many domains where people are not going to be interested in long-term domain modeling effort. They want to make a quick and dirty model, do something with it, okay, and then go on. So for example, web service composition, online, you may not be interested in writing full formal specifications of your web services. You just want help in trying to do pipe together multiple services. Okay, this is our kind of technology isn't meant for that, because we need Jörg Hoffmann or somebody to sit down and write the domain models. Okay, so I think and also sometimes you don't know enough about the model, enough about the web service to actually write a complete and correct model. You have to live with incomplete, possibly incorrect, and over the time evolving models. And this issue brings up this issue kind of makes it front and center that domain model learning is going to be a very important reason why you should be interested in learning. Okay. So if you think about the previous one, this improving speed as sort of any expertise solution to planning, which is you can start with any expertise about how to solve problems with that domain, but over a period of time you increase your expertise, improve your control knowledge about how to solve the problems faster and faster. This is nothing but any model solution, which is any amount of domain physics you know, tell me, I will try to give you some amount of planning support, and then as the model improves, I can improve the planning support. Okay, again, that's a very worthy goal for keeping learning in the loop of planning and learning. Okay, there are many different ways people are interested in it, and you know, I keep calling this model light planning. And the model light planning essentially is you are trying to deal with incompletely specified domain models. Now of course, when you talk about incompletely specified domain models, there's a spectrum of how incomplete is incomplete. Okay, on one hand you can have the complete specification of all the preconditions and effects of the domain. Now when I said that, logicians in this room should kind of be laughing at me, because there is no such thing as complete specification for any real world domain. There is qualification problem, there is frame problem and all that stuff. So you really cannot ever provide complete specification. But the point I'm making is, you even at the benchmark level, you know that you must be missing enough preconditions and effects sometimes, in which case you are sort of trying to be here, but you have approximate models with maybe missing preconditions, missing effects and so on. And on this end, you have no model whatsoever versus having some sort of a shallow model. So for example, in the context of web service composition, there are solutions that are being developed that have been actually reasonably popular, where all the web service composition tool helps the human in the loop is giving them ideas as to, now that you put this service, here are the possible services that you might consider putting next to this. It's a sort of like Amazon's recommendation system. It's just because Amazon recommended that you might be interested in these books, you're not going to buy them. But if the reason they are recommending them is because they are, you know, they profiled you. Okay, in this particular case, the reason you could probably recommend additional services that you can pipe is because you might have domain models about the input-output types of the various services. That's the only thing that you know, nothing more. You don't know preconditions, you don't know effects, but you know input-output types. Okay, that is knowledge. Saying only if I have this full model do I have knowledge, anything else is no knowledge, makes no sense. Okay, so you have to, in this kind of a scenario, you need to deal with three things, one of which is obviously very important for this particular tutorial. You need, of course, planning support for dealing with incomplete and partially complete and continually evolving models. That's important. More importantly, you need to be able to learn these models over a time. So you need action models to be learned. You need to, there's no point in just sticking with the incomplete model that you are left with. Okay. So that's one reason, another reason for learning. Okay, so that's the twin motivations. I just put them back in place, and I would not go through the whole thing, but essentially the speed up motivation can be thought of as any expertise solution. You're trying for any expertise solution for planners. And this one is any model solution. And if you combine both of them, essentially that's a good reason why planning and learning should go together. Okay, this is a slide that I stole from Willa Rummel, who is from Xerox PARC, and he was essentially out there arguing yesterday that in fact there are tons and tons of, according to him at any rate, there are several applications in his industry that he used to be associated with for a long time, but now he's in the university environment, where in fact modeling physical systems and, you know, planning with respect to them is in fact very important, and much of the time what happens is the model is not available. Okay, so for example, he gave this beautiful picture where is the paper going through the roller and it's going to be, you know, hitting this and then turn here and then go through these rollers. This is how various copiers work. Okay, the question is how long exactly does this paper take to go from here to here? Now what you want is the number, the amount of time that will be taken. Obviously you don't have it. In most cases that's just too high a level of detail of the model and they don't have it, and so you have to learn to live with incompletely specified models and improving your performance over a period of time. And I just showed this to say that there are obvious real world applications where the ability to deal with incomplete models and adapt yourself, your performance is important. Okay. Now the last thing that I want to say in this phase, it's sort of like a more of a big why we should care about learning and planning phase, is it's really, I looked at it from the planning side until now, why it is beneficial for the planning side. And all of you are young and upcoming researchers, and you don't want to just use some other ideas from machine learning and just apply them to your problem. You know, I mean, that's like living off of somebody else's intellectual capital, okay, which is okay, I think it makes for a good living, but you might probably be interested in seeing, is there intellectual challenges that are more than just, it's not just an issue for planning, is it a service to the learning too, machine learning community too? And I believe that actually it is very much the case. Okay, if you keep track of what's happening in machine learning nowadays, the kind of problems that you would wind up looking at if you were to do learning in the context of planning are qualitatively different from the kind of problems that are being looked at by the majority machine learning community. They're different in the following way. Planning requires sequential decisions, it often has relational structure, and finally, and probably most importantly, when you are learning for planning, you almost always have background knowledge. You have a previous model that you're trying to improve. Okay, those of you who have background in even learning 101 know that much of the work in machine learning assumes there is tabula rasa, that is, there's no background knowledge, and all you have is a bunch of examples and their labels. Okay, so there used to be work in machine learning which would actually be which would be looking at the knowledge-based aspects of machine learning, and that is something that is, requires a lot of work in that area. And by working in planning and learning, you in some sense would have to work on that problem. That's a great problem. That's the way we learn. We always learn in the context of, I mean, some things we learn just probably without much of a knowledge, but most things we learn because we have biases, we have background knowledge, and we learn from that. And so it's a great problem, and it will wind up being important both for planning and learning communities. So that's the thing. I mean, I just don't want to do an applied tutorial, which is just application of somebody's ideas to my field. Okay, I think it's going to be a new field, really, if you do right. Okay. So that's the part, and now comes the outline as to where we are going to go through with this. And so I kind of did the motivation and big picture. I'll do a very, very brief review, probably I would not do too much of it, of planning and learning for those people who either don't know planning or don't know learning, but I can't really do a reasonable job of that. I have to assume that you know at least planning, and you pick up the learning techniques that are used in planning as we go along. Okay, and then we will basically review the work that's been done in learning of search control and learning of domain models. And as of now, much of the work wound up getting done in this direction, learning of search control knowledge. And remember, pre-1995, there was a big enough reason to just learn search control knowledge, because otherwise you can't solve any reasonable sized problem. Okay, so there were lots of techniques that were developed, search control learning, macro learning, plan reuse, all sorts of various techniques, some of which, you know, may still be useful, but nobody is using them right now. Okay, so I can at least tell you briefly about what those are. And then there's also newer work in this direction, for example, you know, given that most of our current day planners work with reachability heuristics, pretty sophisticated reachability heuristics, right? Why not consider, we all know that those heuristics are still not informed enough. They're relaxed heuristics, obviously. They are obviously going to be wrong in some domain. The question is, why not consider learning improvements over those heuristics? Okay, and there's been great work, you know, some of which actually Sang-wook and his group have done in the past, but other people have also done, and we will overview that too, as to how you can, for example, learn to improve relaxed plan heuristics so that you can beat FF, at least some cases. Okay, and more importantly, as the problem's complexity becomes harder, for example, if you start considering, let's say, oversubscription planning, where you have soft goals and actions with non-uniform costs, it's not, the competition is much hard, you know, is much lighter there, because the domain independent planners are not particularly good there. And it turns out the techniques which improve heuristics through learning wind up being even more impressive there. Okay, so we'll tell you some of those techniques at any rate. Okay, and then we will look at some of the work that's been going on both before and more recently in learning of domain models. That basically there are more open questions there than there are actually obvious solutions, but it's worth looking at them anyway. And one of the interesting things that we'll see when we get there is there are techniques for learning domain models that unfortunately have the wrong assumptions. Some of them, for example, they expect, for example, that you don't know about the domain, but you know a million plans from the domain. Okay. Now, is that a reasonable assumption? Is it more likely that your friend who has a 10 action domain would rather give you 1 million plans from that domain than the 10 actions? Okay. To the extent it's a reasonable assumption, you know, the existing work makes sense. If not, you have to consider how to start with partial models and extra examples of plans and try to improve your domain model. Okay. Again, one theme that you want to keep in your mind is knowledge-based learning, which is basically prior knowledge exists, and with respect to that, you have to improve your current performance. Okay. So that's basically the overview of it, and in terms of the actual logistics of it, I would get out of this place, that means stop boring you, by about 3 o'clock, okay, at which point I hope to be able to get you to learning of the search control knowledge, parts of it. Okay, and then Sang-wook would then take from there and look at the rest of the learning of search control and learning of domain models. He's also the great guy to talk about because he's done several of the more interesting lines of work in the recent past in that direction. And then we will again have like a summary section where we'll have more discussion about what we have talked about now. Okay, so that's the overview. Are there questions before I go forward? Okay. I don't quite know how much to go through this. I'll just go quickly through this. And for those of you who just don't remember the terminology at all, there are two types of learning methods that we would have to care about. Tabula rasa learning, which can be thought of to some extent at a very elementary level as classification learning, where you're trying to, given labels, you're trying to find a classifier that separates them. And, you know, the complexity of the classification learning could of course depend upon, you know, how complex are the class discriminators, the boundaries. Okay. That's one part. The other thing that winds up being very important, and again we'll go into the details more while we go into the actual work, is the reinforcement learning paradigm as a whole. Okay, in fact, basically the reinforcement learning paradigm essentially assumes that it can actually work with no model whatsoever. So all you need is you know the actions, you do the actions in the world, and look at the rewards that you have based on that, learn the model as well as learn the policy. Okay, you can do that together. So in some sense it's like a bedrock model for actually thinking of doing learning and planning together. Okay, again we will look at some of the more technical details of that as and when needed. In fact, you can have an entire tutorial on just reinforcement learning, obviously. Okay, that's another thing that we will keep in mind. One thing that is interesting for us is normally reinforcement learning techniques that are out there available have a variety of assumptions that don't make too much sense for planning, the kind of planning domains that you and I might know. One, of course, is most techniques, the elementary descriptions of them wind up being done in the black box state models. Okay, that's one thing. So in fact, you have factored models, and there are techniques for reinforcement learning which work with factored models. Those are more relevant for us. The other thing is the question of convergence. You know, if you start with totally either, you know, the incomplete or partial models, you don't want to try, you know, a million iterations and slightly improve your knowledge. In some cases, that might be relevant. In some other cases, you might want to actually speed up the convergence process. And that winds up being an important issue in terms of using the reinforcement learning techniques in our context. Actually, Sangwook would talk about how a very interesting way in which models, the reinforcement learning model could be used to actually learn a domain-specific planner, which just essentially learns to do the right action based on the problem. Okay, so he winds up basically you can train the learner offline over the entire domain, and then you're able to solve the problems just as a policy that you have learned. Okay, and then he'll talk about how good that would be in that sense. Okay, so that's the background in reinforcement learning MDP that would be useful. Now, in terms of the dimensions of variation for the machine learning, the learning algorithms that we'll be looking at for this, you know, and the learning and planning problems we'll be looking at, the kinds of things that you want to keep in mind as we go through the variety of techniques that we'll be going through, hopefully, is one is what is being learned. Are you learning search control? Are you learning domain knowledge? Now, it turns out that even within search control and domain knowledge, you can ask this question again. What kind of search control are you learning? Are you learning branching knowledge? Are you learning domain invariants? Are you learning domain properties of various kinds? In fact, you'll see that there are all sorts of different ways in which search control knowledge can be expressed. And similarly, for domain knowledge too, are you learning actions, preconditions, effects, task schemas, and so on and so forth. Okay. The other one is what kind of background knowledge is being used as part of your learning, and is the learning being done online or offline? That's going to be an important issue. How is the training data obtained? Are you expecting millions of traces of plans that have been executed in the past, but you just don't know the model? Or are you expecting demonstrations from humans about a domain? This is actually a very interesting direction that's kind of hot now, which is, what if I have a teacher who gives me demonstrations? Okay, in fact, in the human learning, you learn from partial knowledge about the domain, whatever is the topic that I'm trying to talk about today, plus a few demonstrations, and then you try to figure out what it is, the more about the domain, right? Learning from demonstrations, normally there won't be millions of demonstrations because teachers get sick and tired of you after a while. And so the question is how to do it with few training examples and exploit the knowledge that you have. Okay, that winds up being important. And of course, if you're learning search control knowledge, then at least you have a complete domain model, and hopefully you have your friend FF or some other planner, and you can at least use them to run the problems, you know, try to solve the problems, look at those solutions as the training examples, those solutions, those search trees altogether as the training examples to improve the search control. Okay, so that's easier in that case. And then, of course, the other issue is how is the training data represented? It turns out relational learning would be more relevant for planning domains, but you can always ground everything out and think in terms of, propositional learning. But, you know, relational would be more useful. And then finally, depending on the learning techniques, the learning problem you're doing, how are you generating the features? Okay, if I give you, you know, if you're trying to learn search control knowledge, and you know, what exactly are your features over which you're doing either classification or learning? Okay, so those are some of the issues that you want to keep in mind. We will keep bringing up this slide every once in a while and then make connections to it. But you know, these are some of the issues that obviously matter. Okay, now this is one of the beautiful slides Terry Zimmerman sitting there has made. There is an overview of all the planning and learning techniques that have been done in planning as of 2003, that he's written an overview article, and he basically was trying to make sure that he knows what are all the various systems out there and what are the kinds of techniques they have done, what sort of search control knowledge they are trying to learn, and so on. At the time of writing of this article, most work was really obviously pre-95 work, because as I said, the new interest in learning and planning is coming as we speak. That's why it's interesting to actually talk about it now. The old interest was pre-95 when the planners were very slow. Okay. In between, there was sort of a period when there wasn't that much work that's going on in the planning learning kind of a community. But he did give a nice overview of the techniques, and you know, he basically provides the characterization of the dimensions on which they vary and so on. And I won't obviously go into the entire details, but it might be worth for you in case you're interested in, you know, making sure that you're not repeating something that's already been done, to go back and look at that paper in AI Magazine 2003. Okay, and in fact, this is just a summary that we made of what kind, some of the types of target functions and learning techniques that have been used, but ultimately, again, this is also more of being comprehensive about naming every name that's been done, which is not what I'm going to do in this tutorial. We'll probably look at some of the interesting ideas that are still likely to be useful as we go forward from here. Okay. Okay, this is a thing that I will skip very fast. Basically, I assume that since you are an ICAP and you paid registration, you know planning. Okay, is that a reasonable idea? Or you just had extra money and wanted to come anyway? So, you know, I'll assume that you will know how planning domains would be specified in some reasonable language. I will assume that you will know action definitions and they have preconditions and effects and so on. I'll assume that you can do planning in either forward direction or backward direction, or in fact, I missed a slide, you can also do partial order planning. Okay. And now what's interesting is that depending on the planner that you have, if you are trying to learn search control knowledge that would help the planner, okay, tell it which direction to go on a particular search, you need to know what its branching points are. Okay. And obviously, the kind of search control knowledge that's very useful for a partial order planner, for example, might be how to resolve flaws. Should you resolve open conditions first or unsafe causal links first? And if you were to resolve open conditions, what order should you resolve them? Okay, that's the kind of knowledge that's most useful for causal link planners, partial order planners. For forward and backward state space planners, the question is which of the many children states that I'm trying to expand are the ones I should go forward on, for example. And again, the entire reachability heuristics idea was trying to give those estimates in a sort of a domain independent fashion, you know, without having to do any separate learning. Okay, so normally what you do is for each of these states, you sort of generate a planning graph and then compute the relaxed plan from that, take the length of that or the cost of that and use that as an estimate. That's what we are doing in most of the planners. The question, of course, is obviously it is a relaxation. Can be wrong. You can easily design domains, or in fact, even in the existing domains, it can be easily misled. And so you might want to at least learn the exceptions to the heuristic. Okay. There is the pop algorithm, but I don't have to go in it, other than the fact that you select flaws and you resolve them. Okay. So I actually went through this part very quickly. I basically have talked to you about the dimensions in which the learning techniques might vary and that you might be interested in, and also you know, some very brief review that planning would wind up requiring. If you are interested in control knowledge, the search control depends on the kind of planner you're using. Okay. So now we are going to start into the two important parts. The first one is learning search control. It's really the bigger part. That is because we have more work that we can describe to you on that. It's not because it's the most interesting part necessarily. I think both are interesting, and probably this is even more interesting, but we don't have as much work there. When I say we don't have, I mean we the community, not we, just me and Sangu, because there's a lot of people who work on it, but there isn't that much work in that area to talk about. Okay, but it's still interesting. Okay, so planner customization. So we will be talking about search control knowledge, and this is the part where I sort of start off, and then I will leave Sangwook to continue for the rest of it. But let me get you to the part, the natural delineation, it turns out, is that I used to do machine learning pre-95. And in fact, I wound up doing a lot of work on speed up learning right after my thesis, and I don't want to tell you when I got my thesis, that's too unnecessary for you. But I did work on plan reuse and search control rule learning, etc., and I'm quite familiar with that literature, and I can actually tell you at least what we were doing. And then more of the recent work in speed up for planners, I think Sangwook would actually be a good guy to describe it because he's done some of it too. Okay, so it's not an arbitrary distinction, it's like there's a reason why we are splitting it that way. Okay, so you saw this slide already. We are interested in customizing planners, right? Now you want to look at how to make this planner as good as the best domain specific planner somebody can write for the domain. That's the holy grail. If you are interested only in search control knowledge, you know the domain physics completely. There's no question about that. You know the actions, you know the preconditions, you know the effects. The real question is how to get the performance equaling that of somebody's C code for that particular domain. Okay. Now, how is the customization done? There are two ways that have been done, and it's actually interesting to see the difference. First, actually look at this, unfortunately, look at the first one in the machine learning side. Pre-95, when people were looking at speed up, most of the work that was done was things like learning search control rules, trying to say when you are at this particular node and the following condition holds, take the leftmost branch or the rightmost branch. That's the kind of search control rule. Now, these are exactly the control rules that are like extremely hard for humans to write. Because what is a node? Node has semantics only for the procedure. There is no domain specific semantics for node. Okay, the node depends on, for a partial order planner, a node is a partial plan with open conditions, causal links and unsafe links and so on. For a forward state space planner, it is a legal state. For a backward state space planner, it is a set of goals that it's trying to achieve for that. Okay. Now, however, for a learner, how does it matter? And as long as the search control knowledge that you learn is being used by your own planner, it doesn't matter how arcane it looks. And there's been work on UCPOP EBL or Prodigy EBL and etc., which all of which try to learn search control rules for specific types of planners. Okay. And there is the work on things like case-based planning, where you remember some of the plans that have been developed in the past for a particular problem. You index them, and when you see new problems that seem to have similarities for that, or some of the problems that you have seen in the past, you retrieve them, try to use them again. Okay. A version of that case-based planning, of course, is macros, where in essence what you would wind up doing is you say that some of the commonly occurring patterns of actions, you just combine them into a new macro, new operator. Okay. And that just increases the number of actions you have now. And then you wind up just using it as part of your planning. Okay, if it's you're the partial order planner or forward or backward state. The difference between macro learning and the case-based planning essentially is that in one case, in macros, you don't wind up changing the interior of the sequence. The entire sequence now becomes a new action for you. What that means is from the search terms, it increases the branching factor. If you have more macros, you have basically increased the B, and hopefully it reduces the D. So you're trying to improve the search control by increasing the B, reducing the D. And of course, if you increase B too much, then you wind up doing worse. Okay. So one of the issues that winds up becoming important in this kind of scenarios is, and that's particularly true for macros, but it's true in general for all sorts of search control, is there is a cost to actually having these extra macros hanging around. In this particular case, it increases the number of branches, okay? And there's a benefit in terms of the reduced depth the solution is going to be found at. And you have to make sure that the costs don't overwhelm the benefit. And more importantly, you have to start throwing away macros which are not found to be useful enough, okay? This is sort of like caching strategies. You know, when do you cache, when do you keep a page in the memory, main memory as against sending it back to the disk? And you know, you sometimes have to throw things out, and you know, some of the issues of caching strategies are very similar to some of the issues that you wind up finding in macros and case-based learning. And in the case of case-based planning, the issue is slightly different. Again, it's the utility, this problem has been called the utility problem, which is you having all these extra search control knowledge, but instantiating it in a particular problem might be more costly than the expected benefits from it. And so you have to keep track of your expectation of how likely is it going to be useful. Okay. Now, in the case of case-based planning, the costs are storage, retrieval. That's the cost that you're going to use. Okay. There are also within planning community, even though we don't think of it as learning, but there are systems like DiscoPlan and so on that, given a PDDL specification, can try to find you static mutexes of any order, you know, binary mutexes, ternary mutexes, and so on, saying that given the domain dynamics, there are no legal states where the following set of facts can all be together. That's a domain invariant, essentially. Okay, and learning that could be useful, and for certain types of planners in particular. Okay, and we know, for example, mutexes are very useful for graph plan. Mutexes can also be useful for SAT-oriented planners and so on. And that is another type of learning that can be, that has been done. And then there is this issue of abstraction, which essentially tries to say that which conditions have to be worked on, which preconditions should you achieve first before which preconditions. Okay, and to the extent you wind up working on the most important ones first and then work on the details, you can reduce the amount of search that you do. This is sort of an overview of search control learning that's been done for automated learning, from the automated learning techniques, okay, especially pre-95. One big thing that's changing, the two other things that I haven't talked about here that, you know, Sangwoo could talk about, is one, how to improve an existing heuristic. Okay, so if you have a relaxed plan heuristic, how to improve it based on, you know, a set of problems that you work on. Okay, and the other one, of course, is how to learn domain-specific planners directly. In a way, everything you're doing here is a domain-specific planner, because a simple domain physics, a PDDL planner plus search control knowledge for a particular domain is a domain-specific planner for that domain. Because now, when the domain changes, not only should you remove the PDDL specification, you also have to remove all the search control rules, because they only work for this particular domain. Okay. The other thing that, in contrast to the kind of knowledge that we know how to learn, the thing that was interesting is the kind of learning, the knowledge that was learned in the knowledge-based planning track. Okay, because I told you one of the reasons we might be interested in this is because knowledge-based planning track planners did well, quite a bit better than the domain independent planners. Okay, so the question is, what was the kind of knowledge they were writing? Upfront, you have to realize that nobody in their right mind, you know, if humans are writing this knowledge, they would never be writing this kind of knowledge. It's very painful, which is, you know, if you were to be doing UCPOP version from Washington, University of Washington, then you must use this search control rule for this particular branching division. That's very painful to write for humans. Okay. Instead, they obviously will write more sort of a declarative knowledge that is sort of true based on the domain knowledge, and that winds up being useful for any set of planners. Okay. For example, an example of that kind is things like the abstraction and things like invariant detection. Those are declarative, because you just look at the domain and you can say that there is no state where A and B and C can be holding together. Okay. Whether that's going to be useful for your planner or not, I don't care. I'm just telling you extra knowledge that just follows from the domain specification. Okay. Now the interesting thing, of course, is the kind of things that So the type of declarative rules that were used in the KB, knowledge-based planning track, was things like HTN schemas, which are essentially task reduction schemas. I'll show you an example of it in a minute, which over and above the underlying PDDL actions tell you these are the ways you should go towards legal solutions. Okay? And that those are declarative control knowledge, or they could be for example, the kind of things that TL plan has done, which are search control rules, which are rules over sequence of states that you would encounter when you start executing a plan. Okay, so for example, this would, you know, so here I'm saying these kind of rules are saying in a given state, A and B and C cannot be true together. But I can also say that if you have a state where A is true, and then have a state where B is true, then you should never have a state right after that where A becomes false. Now, for any good plan, for example. Or I could at least say, if you have a state where A is true, and, you know, I have a state where A becomes false, then you have an A becoming true again. That's not part of any good plan. I can say that kind of knowledge, and that would be the kind of knowledge that TL plan actually winds up writing, for the hand controller. Okay, now notice that those are not exactly the kind of things that were learned by automated learners in general. Okay. Now, of course, there is also Sharp, which is a great planner that also won the knowledge-based planning competition. There, it essentially learns an entire domain-specific planner. Sharp winds up being a way to write domain-specific planners easily by hand. Okay, and so in that case, it's writing the entire planner. Okay, those are the kinds of things. And let me show you examples of them. The examples, again, very quickly, task decomposition would be of the kind, these are all the primitive actions that are defined in your PDDL, and you have, let's say, an higher level non-primitive action like travel, which can only be done by going either by bus or going by tram, and going by bus would wind up becoming a overall plan sequence of getting into the bus, buying the ticket and getting out. Okay. Now the idea then is, when I give you this, what I'm saying is every legal solution must be possible by this kind of schema. Okay. Now it's kind of an interesting scenario. Normal planner would have just found any sequence, whether it's possible by those schemas or not. HTN planners have to find sequences that are possible by those schemas. But the way HTN planners tend to work normally is they use the schemas themselves, come top down, that cuts down the search when they work well. Anyway. Okay, since people are writing this, it's worth trying to learn, given a PDDL domain, given a huge number of action sequences corresponding to plans from that domain, could you learn these hierarchical task reduction schemas instead of having people write them? Okay, that's a classic great learning problem. In fact, there are it's like way too popular right now, because in this particular conference there are like close to 6 or 7 papers, and Ugur yesterday in the learning and planning workshop said stop working on it, because I think he wants to work and write more papers. But anyway, it's an interesting problem, and in fact it's still open to the extent that there are no effective techniques. Now the Sharp basically allows you to write an entire high level procedural language for solving domain. Okay. This I don't even actually expect to be able to learn directly. Instead, for machine learning, from the machine learning side, Sangwook will tell you how you could just direct some of the techniques that are out there, which will try to learn domain specific planners directly without. So basically, instead of providing knowledge about which branch to take for an existing planner such as FF or something, it just is a black box which looks at the state and says this action, next state, this action, next state, this action. So it learns a policy over the state and the problem space. Okay, so that could be a good way of coming to this direction, which is completely domain specific planner. Okay, the other thing that I mentioned quickly earlier was the kind of knowledge that TL plan was using. Again, the only reason I'm looking at TL plan and Sharp is because as long as knowledge-based planning track was running, they kept winning the prizes, first and second, second and first, depending on the year. And then they stopped running them because, I don't know why. But either way, basically the kind of things that CL plan would allow you to write is formulas that must hold true on any good state sequences that lead you to the solution. So the difference between the TL plan things and that state invariance is state invariance are with respect to a single state, where in the single state the following facts cannot be true or they must be true. Here you are talking about if this is true in a state, then some other things must be true at later state. Okay. Now to give you an idea of this, looks like maybe we can learn this. Here is the kind of knowledge that Fahim Bakas wrote up for solving blocks world domain. Okay, this tells you how to learn good towers. It's a good tower if you clear X and there is a good tower below you, and you have a good tower below you if the following statement holds on the state sequence up to that point. And basically the idea then is to keep going good towers, and whenever the good tower is not true, stop that branch. No, this sounds almost like the Woody Allen's advice to graduate students, which basically goes to say that the future is full of pitfalls, there are also opportunities, avoid the pitfalls, take the opportunities and go home. You know, it's very hard, it's an inoperational advice. I don't quite see, learning this is a non-trivial task, okay. Of course, I mean, Fahim thought about this, you know, and so obviously he's a great planner, but it's learning these kinds of formulas is still open right now. As given a bunch of good action sequences that solve the problem, can you automatically learn something like this? So you have something to aim at, okay. At least you can, and in fact there was some discussion yesterday that if you can learn one of these things automatically, you should get a Dana, because Dana now was able to write these, and if you can learn these automatically, then you should get a Fahim, because Fahim was able to learn it. You know, so this is human level performance of search control. Okay. Now, so I kind of told you what are the type of things that were learned in the automated in the pre-95 search community, in the planning learning community, and I also talked about what seemed to be the kind of knowledge that seems to be actually working well in the knowledge based planning track, and that could be worth learning. Okay, for the rest of now, actually, we were going to basically look at more closely some of the specific examples of the kinds of search control knowledge that was learned and the techniques that were used. Okay, and here is the, this is just here is the top level overview of what we're going to do. So for learning search control, you could either do speed up learning or you could do from scratch. Okay, what I mean by speed up learning is there exists an actual planner. It can be FF, it can be somebody else, it has its own branching points and so on, and what you're trying to do is assist that planner to do things faster. Okay. On the other hand, as this side, which is just learn from scratch how to plan, which is just develop a domain specific planner. I don't particularly care what your planner is, just give me a domain specific planner. Okay. So this could be SHOP, this could be emulating SHOP, this could be emulating, for example, adding TL plan like search control rules on top of a forward search planner, for example. Okay. In the case of improving existing planner, again, you can split the work that's been done into learning search control rules that guide choice points, okay, and learning to reuse plans. Again, I mentioned this, I just, in the next 5 minutes or so, I'll give you a little more details on this, learning search control rules and learning choice, to reuse plans, okay. And then the third thing, which seems to be actually quite useful in these days, is learning adjustments to domain independent heuristics, because after all, it seems reasonable not to have to learn from scratch what you already seem to have for granted, because this entire idea of domain independent reachability heuristics is up for grabs, it's available freely for us. So why don't we start from there and try to improve them, okay. So that part onwards, I'll quickly tell you something about this and this. There's a lot of actual specific papers that were written on these two, but many of them are pre-95, so it's okay if I don't go into too much detail on them. And then Sangup will come and talk about this, and then he will also talk about how to go about learning from scratch planners. Okay, and then that will complete the first part of learning, which is learning search control knowledge, and then we'll talk about domain learning domain model. Okay. Question. You look sufficiently stunned, so I think we can continue. Okay. Like I said, I'm not going to give you specific algorithms in a great detail for these, because much of this work was done long enough back. I'm more interested in telling you what might be the lessons that you can carry from some of those techniques into, you know, what you want to do now. So just think about learning, so the first thing I'm thinking about is learning rules to guide choice points, okay. The simplest idea is training data. What's training data which learns rules to guide choice points? Training data is abundant. The dumber your plan, the more the training data, because every planner goes in various search branches, backtracks from them, goes in other branches, backtracks from them until it finds a solution. So every branch other than the branch that led to the solution can be thought of as a not good branch. You can't actually say they're definitely wrong branches, but you might be able to say they are not promising branches. And the ones that led you to the goal, eventual goals, are positive exemplars. Okay? So you could start with that. Positive examples are the search nodes in the success path and the decisions that led to them. And negative examples are the search nodes on all other branches which are taking you away from the success path. Okay? And then given these are positive and negative examples, you can use any type of classification learning techniques. You know, obviously the ones that can deal with, you know, relational learners would be more useful, but that's a good place to start from. And there's been work, I mean, long back, they were work on directly applying straightforward inductive learning algorithms, you know, of like decision lists and so on to do this. Okay? Now, one thing that you may not think about right away is, so this is like the simplest way to think about, which is, you know, there are positives and there are negatives, I don't know anything else, let me just find some sort of a characterization for the positives that separates them from negatives. That's a straightforward classification learning. But is it really true? Do we really not know anything about what's wrong about the bad paths and what's right about the good paths? Actually, we know what's wrong about the bad paths. Many a time, rather than say this path is dead, you can say here exactly is the specific set of constraints in this search node that have doomed it to failure. So for example, consider this, it's a really busy figure, this corresponds to actually a partial order planner, and in fact pre-95, some of the best planners were partial order, pre-95, the fastest planners were partial order planners. And so in fact we would be trying to improve the performance of the partial order planners, because why improve the performance of the losers? Improve the performance of the winners, and those were the winners at that time. And so partial order planner, here is, it's like a little domain where you're trying to polish something and make it cylindrical. So make some widget cylindrical and polish it also. Now it turns out that, you know, a simple, any reasonable domain would say that after you polish, if you try to make it cylindrical, the polish is gone. Okay, so you must do it cylindrical, make it cylindrical first and then polish it. Okay, that's the usual interaction in this domain. And when you, here is a search path which basically starts from this null plan, gets to this plan, this plan, this plan, this plan, and then it turns out that it doesn't go any further, because here it winds up having a failure, here it winds up having a failure. So the plans that come here and here are failing plans. Now, there is a reason why they fail, because in this particular case, there is an ordering cycle here, there is another ordering cycle here, and cyclic ordering are not going to work for, you know, a partially ordered plan. Now that I can actually explain why this is a failing branch here, I can say, don't ever do that again. Don't get me to that particular failure reason. So, I should never do this action whenever certain conditions which after this action would lead me to here are present here. So in essence, what I need to do is I take the reason for failure, regress it through this decision to find the footprint of the failure reason in the previous node. And similarly do it from here, conjoin them. If both of them are present, then that is the failure explanation for this guy. And then you regress it over this node to get the failure explanation for this guy. Now what we are doing in essence is I'm telling you what are the features of this branch that actually are causing it to fail. And I'm able to do it because I have the domain knowledge. I know what is a failure, what is a success in this domain, and I know, for example, that these two constraints are here. It's a very simple failure explanation because it's an ordering cycle. And by the time you come here, the reason is these, and there is an open condition and there is an effect of this type. And by the time you come here, and finally if you regress it finally top enough, you will get a nice rule like this, which says if you ever have a node which has an open condition trying to polish an object X, and it's not already true that that object is polished to begin with, then avoid doing rolling action at that point. Because when you do rolling action, the polish goes up. Okay? So again, you could potentially learn this from the kind of inductive learning of, you know, the positive examples, negative examples. But the problem is there are so many features that are present on the successful path and failure path, which are important, which are not important. We normally hope that our learners tell us. If you give enough examples, you will figure out what are the important features. But we do actually have the knowledge in the background. So why not use it? Okay. One way of using this knowledge that I just told you, this one I use the word explanation. I'm using the explanation of failure here. I'm regressing it over the decision to get the explanation of failure here and going forward. Explanation-based learning is one example of knowledge-based learning techniques. Okay. And in fact, a lot of work that was done pre-95 was using explanation-based learning in planning. And that's something worth remembering. Even if they wind up, those exact techniques don't wind up being useful right now, the idea of exploiting background knowledge is a great idea. Because why would you not want to use background knowledge to figure out what are relevant features and what are not relevant features? Okay? Because it reduces the number of examples you need. For example, notice what happened. Here I just had one failing path and I could learn this rule. To do this from induction, I might need large number of failing paths, large number of successful paths to be able to learn this rule. Okay? So that's the power of prior knowledge and being able to use it. So that's the explanation-based learning. If you want to think about it in the context of example-based learning, the easiest thing to do is when you have a labeled example, using your background knowledge, you try to provide an explanation, plausible explanation as to why it has that label. Okay, and based on that explanation, every property of that example that took part in that explanation is relevant to it having that label. And then basically that becomes a feature selection problem. Okay, you used background knowledge to select the feature. And then you can do induction on top of it. In this particular case, actually I was done right after analyzing one branch, I was done. I actually got the rule that I am interested in. But in some other cases, I might be able to use this to at least remove some of the irrelevant features, and then that improves the later the induction step. Because I have, yes, sir. No, basically, all you need to know is what did. See, if you think about this, when you know most of the planners essentially are refinement planners. You can think of them as starting with a set of constraints and adding more constraints. Many planners are like that. You know, and so every decision actually checks whether the current plan has certain constraints, and if so, it adds another constraint. So that's just when you're regressing, you see if it's already added, then you don't have to take it back. If it wasn't added, then it must have been present previously. Okay. By the way, when I'm describing this to you, you might also have realized that this is how dependency-directed backtracking would work. Okay, which is not at all surprising. In fact, explanation-based learning and dependency-directed backtracking are very closely related. The only difference is after dependency-directed backtracking realizes that what went wrong was somewhere here and restarts from here, you now also remember this rule so that you can avoid doing this. So from the CSP community, what I'm learning is something like a no good, except I wrote it as a search control rule. Okay, but the bigger issue I want you to understand is you can have the background knowledge to sort of figure out what are the relevant and irrelevant features. Again, in the EBL, so you can use that to explain. Now, I want you to kind of put your mind around this. I don't know how my car works. I'm very bad with mechanics. Okay? But when my car stops working one day, I have an incomplete model. I don't have zero model of how my car works. I have an incomplete model of how my car works. I, for example, know that the color of my car has nothing to do with whether it starts today or not. Okay? So when my car stops working, I would at least avoid color of the car today as an irrelevant feature for my induction learner as to what is the reason the car failed. Okay? So even if I have incomplete knowledge, that's very useful. I don't need complete knowledge. Okay? One other thing, and if you ever go back and tell somebody else Rav said EBL kind of ideas could be useful for this, one thing you might hear is there were some misunderstandings in the community itself, in the machine learning community itself, as to what EBL is supposed to be. It wound up being used in the context where you have complete and correct domain knowledge. Just because it got used in the context where you had complete and correct domain knowledge, people assume that you must have complete and correct domain knowledge to do EBL. That's not true. I can use my partial knowledge about how my car works to cut down the learning time. At least I won't be repainting my car to make it work fast, to start. Okay, which is, it's not a laughable matter, because your learner, which is just going by examples, could very easily do it if it has a paucity of examples. That's an important thing. If you have millions of examples, hopefully there would be enough same color scenario where the car is working, so you would realize that color has nothing to do with car not working. But what if you only had one example? And remember that we want to learn some single demonstrations, few demonstrations, because that's what is very important. And so you want to be able to exploit the knowledge. So anyway, so this kind of knowledge-based explanation of the label can go hand in hand with any of the inductive learning mechanisms that you know, and you can use that to learn search control rules. There are sort of interesting ideas even there. For example, so how to give good explanations for failure. Sometimes you may have stopped going on a branch not because you actually had a detectable failure, but because you ran out of patience. Now what do you do? In that case, how do you give an explanation? Sometimes it turns out that you may still be able to give an explanation by using background domain knowledge to see if there are inconsistencies in that particular plan and use that as a failure explanation and go back. Okay? That's an example. That's the kind of interesting challenges that would come there. One other thing I want to point out is this sort of EBL technique, if you have complete and correct domain knowledge, it just winds up being remembering no goods, okay? And when GraphPlan first came around, those of you who actually remember the original GraphPlan algorithm, you would know that it remembers memos, okay? Memo is essentially a set of propositions that it could not make true, starting at level K backward. And if it ever failed, it would remember those K propositions as a memo. So that if it ever tries to remember, try to solve at that level, those K plus any more, it will declare failure. Okay? It was a simplistic, no good learning mechanism, because it's just this particular failure. I mean, the minimum learning you should do is you should never fail exactly the same way tomorrow. That much, you know, is required. The question, of course, is are all the K things relevant for the failure, or is it only a subset of them that are relevant for the failure? And doing EBL in the context of GraphPlan will allow you to realize, for example, that if there is a 32 size memo, I remember in logistics domain, the average size of memos used to be 32. Okay? But if you actually use the domain knowledge to figure out what were the reasons the failure was occurring, the average no good size would be more like 8. Imagine how much more effective the failure explanation would be if you say, whenever you are trying to achieve these 8 or any superset of them, you fail. As against whenever you are trying to achieve these 32 are a superset of them, you are trying to fail. Okay? Again, the same idea. In the context of GraphPlan, the way I used it is in the context of complete domain knowledge. But I actually want you to think more in terms of what if you only have incomplete domain knowledge. You may not be able to learn from a single example, but you can use it as a pre-processing step, as a feature selection step for your inductive learning. Yes, sir? So again, that's the other interesting issue. Any kind of search control knowledge, okay, this is true if you go tomorrow, and do the wrong thing and go into the CPE conference, you would hear an invited talk by Fahim Bakas on caching. When is caching good? Okay, what is caching in CSP? It's no good learning. And why is he asking when is no good learning good? Because there is a utility problem. If you remember too many no goods, you will be spending time trying to retrieve them. But this is true not just for search control knowledge. In general, it is true for all learned knowledge. If you learn way too much stuff which is not relevant to what you're trying to do, your head is full. And you're basically wasting time trying to retrieve the relevant knowledge. Okay. In search control, it becomes even more of a problem because you wind up doing it at each search node oftentimes. It kind of gets exponentially magnified. Okay. Again, that's the other thing that I want you to... So again, I won't go into this so much, but if anybody tells you maybe this stuff has been done before, why would it work? You could look at this. Prior knowledge and using prior knowledge cannot be a bad thing. What we need is effective techniques for doing it. The beginnings of that were in the EBL movement, in the old machine learning techniques, but there's much more I can do from there. Okay. Again, what are these? The misconception, EBL does not need complete and correct domain knowledge. Any partial knowledge, knowing that color of my car doesn't make it stop or start, is useful for me in learning, why my car is not working. Misconception two, EBL is competing with inductive learning. It's not competing. They are actually, they can go hand in hand. You can cut down irrelevant features and so you'll have more relevant features to explain things with. Okay? And then misconception three, utility problem is somehow endemic to EBL. No. It's sort of endemic to search control learning in general, and it's even more endemic to all of learning in general, because if you learn too much knowledge, you have to sort of try to use it, and when you're trying to retrieve it, you have a problem. So learning goes hand in hand with forgetting. That's what you do. When we sleep, we forget much of the things that happened today. That's why we actually live through the next day. Okay. So I think that's a misconception that you want to avoid having. Okay. Strangely enough, I'm stuck in the sense that we have 15 minutes. So I basically completed the parts that I wanted to tell you about. No, I think there's one more thing. Let's see. I can use these next 10 minutes, and then after the coffee break, Sangoot will take over. That would be a good place to end. Okay, so this is all about EBL. And the other part that I want to tell you, this is all about search control rule learning, either using inductive learning techniques or knowledge-based learning techniques or both. Okay, that's the part that I've talked about. The other part I wanted to talk about before ending my part is learning plans by reuse. This was something that's been done a lot. Okay, and in fact, if you think about it, the only planner that actually did learning and took part in a competition and got some sort of a certificate ever since automated planning competition started, unless in the automated planning track, is FF Macro, which essentially learned macros, okay, which can be thought of in terms of as a plan reuse sort of a scenario where you're looking for, you know, frequently occurring patterns and remembering them, okay. It's just a different way of supporting search control. Either, you know, if you don't know how to solve this problem, try to solve it by picking a similar problem and slashing it into the middle of the solution. Or try to solve it by using search control knowledge, which tells me at each node which direction to go. And it turns out that you can combine those two too, and then we'll show that in a minute. Okay, what's the macro? A macro essentially is any time you find a commonly occurring sequence of operators in any plan, you might consider storing that as whole entire operator, and then you can easily figure out what are the most general preconditions for this sequence of operators and most what are the effects for this sequence of operators. Furthermore, you can generalize it in terms of removing irrelevant preconditions and also variabilizing them, so removing the constant. Okay. Now it turns out that you will then remember these macros. You don't even have to remember them as ground sequences. You can remember them just as PDDL action schemata. It will be a new PDDL action schemata. Okay. Now of course I think FF macro actually uses it as a ground operator, because one of the little known sad things that happened in the planning community is we all do ground planning. All the planners that you know and love, they all use completely ground operator. And I can kill every one of your planners by just giving domains where there are gazillion and billion constants. It's just a cheap way of killing planners. You know, if you ever want a way to kill them, just take the blocks for billion blocks. That's it. And especially if you're going in the power direction, you know, you can die right away. Okay? But so in fact, originally PDDL specification is given in the variabilized or a lifted representation, and you can actually remember macros also in the lifted form. FF macro didn't have to do it because it was sticking with FF, which ultimately takes lifted operators and makes them ground anyway, so it didn't have to go back. But in fact, one of the things is if you found, for example, that in this scenario I picked A, and so my problem was to put A on B and C on D, okay, and I got a plan which is put on AB and then put on CD, and that worked for this particular scenario. I want to remember this as a sequence and a macro operator that will always work in those kinds of conditions. My question would be, what should be the preconditions and what should be the effects I should remember in the lifted form, in the parameterized form? It turns out that you can use again explanation-based learning for this case to generalize the macro operator. Okay, so in particular, the more interesting thing is to realize that if in fact B and C were the same, then this won't work, because here it's not ordered, right? And if the order, so for example, what it does here, in this case, even though this was an ordered plan, by realizing that these are all different blocks, I can actually come up with a macro operator which is a partially ordered sequence, which says as long as these are all different blocks, these are, that's what your inequality constraints are saying, I can do these in any order. Now maybe your planner doesn't care about it, whether they are unordered or not, but some other planners would care. If you are a partially ordered planner, it's very useful for you to know that these two actions don't have to be ordered unnecessarily. Okay, so it's in fact, remembering macro operators winds up being figuring out what are common subsequences, generalizing them and storing them as extra operators. On top of it, of course, all of these have this issue of when to throw away some of these operators. That's the usual utility problem. Okay. Another thing, a different idea, is macros will wind up becoming opaque new actions. Okay, so when I store this, the assumption, the definition of macro, you know, at least in the literature, is now this will become an operator. It will be called O7, whose preconditions are these, effects are these. You take the whole thing or don't take the whole thing. That's the assumption. So that's why it just increases the branching factor at every node by one, because you have to consider this extra operator. Okay? Another possibility, which is reasonably obvious, is to say, why not remember this plan, generalize it, store it, and when I get a new problem that I'm trying to solve, look at this plan, see which parts of them are relevant, only splice those into the new solution, leave the rest out. That's not that hard. Okay, if you do that, you basically get into the realm of plan reuse and case-based planning. At least that's the terminology. Okay, I'm basically telling you which papers you would read to figure out, you know, the techniques for this. So in the case-based planning and plan reuse, you're remembering basically a big database of plans that are being stored, and then given a new problem, while you're trying to solve it, you can, before you even before you do your thing, which is whatever FF or your UC Power planner is trying to do, you might want to first retrieve some plans and see if they can be spliced in to the current plan. Okay, that's the usual idea of plan reuse, and it turns out that in fact there's a whole bunch of literature on this. There's not that many systems that are doing it nowadays. It was a useful crutch in improving performance pre-95 actually. I don't quite know whether it will be again useful now. I don't know, because nobody has done this work again, but we do know some ideas, other ideas which work anyway, so we'll talk more about those to you. But one thing I want to tell you is, even if you are remembering plans, one idea, actually two things I want to tell you. One is, even if you are remembering plans, you can also remember whether, suppose you retrieve this plan in a new scenario, you splice it into your solution and you failed, it couldn't be extended. Okay, because this plan's actions came into your current partial plan, you failed. It turns out you can analyze the failure, you can learn the explanation as to what went wrong in putting this plan, this partial plan into the current problem, and throw that into the index of this plan, saying don't ever retrieve this plan whenever these following conditions are true. Even if it raises its hand saying I'm similar, you hit back it on its head and say, look, the following things are true in my current problem, you can't come back. I can do this automatically just by analyzing failures that happen. In fact, there's a system called DERES NLP that's in J1997 Laurie Eirig and I did, which essentially does that, which basically combines reuse with explanation-based analysis of failures. Okay? That's one thing that you can do. The other thing, even though plan reuse, I don't particularly believe that plan reuse would be the way to improve search control in the current day, for complete domain model scenario. I don't really believe it. So if you are asking me, are you going to do work on this to compete, I'm probably not going to do it. Okay. However, I think plan reuse has a very interesting use if you have incomplete domain models. In this particular case, I was actually able to analyze the failure because I knew the complete domain model and I knew exactly why it failed. Now, why do you actually remember recipes? You know how we do cooking? We remember recipes. Why do we remember recipes? Why can't we have an FF in our head which tries to just do planning? Because most of us are lousy cooks. We have no clue how to cook well. Okay? So at least if it's a recipe that worked somewhere, you try to do the whole thing and maybe in the end add cardamom to it and assume hopefully that it won't ruin the entire dish. Right? So you are hoping that even though I don't know the entire domain model, the guy who made the original plan that worked hopefully knew it. right? And then if I to the extent I only do minor tweaks to this, maybe its correctness and optimality might survive. Do you understand what I'm saying? So reuse and case-based planning actually are quite useful when you are stuck with incomplete domain model. So it might come back yet. So it may be worth understanding why it is interesting and what worked before. Not because it will be useful for the current IPC planning competition, but it because it could be useful when you have incomplete and evolving domain model. Because any plan that works is telling you something. You may not know why it worked, but it worked. So keep that. And then hopefully, you know, if you have partial explanation as to why it worked, at least avoid, you know, avoid worsening, I mean, conflicting with that explanation when you're extending it. Okay. So what's interesting actually is when original case-based planning came in, this was the work by Hammond and Roger Shank and all these people, right? They originally, the idea was to do case-based planning only in scenarios where you don't have complete domain knowledge. You don't have domain knowledge other than cases. Where is case-based reasoning used the most in day-to-day life? Who are the people who care about cases? Lawyers. You know, they go look at these huge, big books to look for precedents. That's case-based reasoning is very big in law. You know, law. Why? Because we have no clue how the judges decide their decisions. All you know is they have done this in the past. So if you can at least tell them, look, you did this last time around. How can you now say no to me because you let me do it last time? That's exactly the cases where there is no complete domain knowledge, and the cases are the domain knowledge is where case-based planning is most useful. And so it can still be useful. And another interesting thing, and on the same vein, is that when hierarchical task network planning came along, originally, it too was brought in to handle the possibility that there is no such thing as a complete domain model. You never will be able to compute all the preconditions and effects of all the actions. Your primitive actions are somebody else's non-primitive actions. Okay, your primitive actions are your secretary or slave non-primitive actions, and your non-primitive actions are your boss's primitive actions. And so you can keep going any further down. And so one of the interesting things is some of these ideas have implications, projections, both in the context of complete and correct domain models that you all know and love, and they also have equally important implications and consequences to partially complete and evolving domain models that I think are going to be much more important, and that we will get to in the second half of the tutorial that I hope you'll all come back to. Okay? So we will stop here, go have coffee, come back, we'll tell you some of the techniques that actually are working right now in terms of search control with the complete and correct domain models. We'll also tell you techniques that are working in terms of domain model learning, and we will talk about what is worth doing. Okay? That's it. Thank you for your attention.